That's loud. So first of all, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me here. And I must say I'm extremely impressed to see how this whole field of foundations of quantum mechanics evolved in the last couple of years from conferences many years ago that were mostly devoted to interpretations and to other philosophical things, but sometimes quite sterile, to this host of so many new results that are appearing. Now, the organizers are also very good, and I don't know whether either by genius or by sheer luck they scheduled Gilles' talk as being the first, which was probably the best introduction into the problems that we are facing today. As he told, you know, if you look at a theory like special relativity, for example, which can be derived from very natural principles, like all frames of reference are equivalent, and there is a finite speed for a propagation of signals, they look completely, completely different from the axioms of quantum mechanics that are very mathematical and not too much insight into them. Now, as I was listening to these words, I couldn't help but agree with every single one of them, and in fact recognize almost single one of them, because this is exactly what I used to hear as I was growing up scientifically. And this was what Yakir Aharonov used to teach and continues to teach in every of his lessons. So already since 86, I was used with these ideas. In fact, they were there to form my my interest. Of course, they were not using the tables of law that you really need the genius of Charlie to introduce them. And also no talk about commitment and other things, like in Gilles' case. What Yakir was telling all the time, in fact going beyond this, is that whenever you try to say something about quantum mechanics in sort of natural worlds, all that you say is sort of negative. You know, if you try to measure this, you disturb that, things are uncertain. Now, it is very difficult to start and build an axiomatic way from such types of statements. However, paraphrasing Einstein, who said that God doesn't play dice, Aharonov said, look, by now we know enough quantum mechanics to see that it actually does play dice, so probably the best question would be, why does God play dice? That is, what are the new liberties that quantum mechanics offers by being a non-deterministic theory? And one of these liberties is, in fact, the liberty of having non-local effects at the same time being consistent with special relativity and no signaling. As a matter of fact, it's even more interesting, because you can think as non-locality to be the primary idea. And now if you say, look, suppose I want a theory that is non-local, but at the same time is consistent with relativity, then you find out that this theory must be non-deterministic. Because if you do something here and something else wiggles there immediately in the response, the only way in which you cannot signal is if this thing was some sort of uncertain from the beginning, and you cannot see the wiggling, or you cannot distinguish it from things that could have happened just by chance. So you can have, on one hand, a non-deterministic theory that does not have non-locality. That is very possible. On the other hand, if you think of non-locality as the primary issue, you immediately get non-determinism as a bonus. So this is an indication that you are on the correct track. And in fact, this was exactly what motivated Daniel Rohrlich and I when we tried to take seriously this idea and see perhaps we can derive quantum mechanics out of it. Now, there is a catch here. In fact, Daniel Rohrlich and I did something different from what Aharonov was thinking of, because he didn't think of bell-type non-locality. What he was thinking was something completely different, and that is the subject of my talk, that is dynamical non-locality. That is the non-locality of the equations of motion in quantum mechanics. The simple fact that we took the other choice to look at non-local correlation was simply because we were not able to do what he had in mind in the first place. I still don't know how to do it. Okay, so before telling you what dynamic non-locality is, I want to mention that in almost all discussions these days, we were focused on the kinematic structure of quantum mechanics. And the hope was to deduce, say, the Hilbert space structure or the bounds on non-local correlations from some basic principles. But the actual dynamics was sort of mostly ignored. Or, for the very best, all that one would say is that it has to be reversible. So if indeed it is a Hilbert space, it would be a unitary, or perhaps it's something more general. But suppose that even if you would be able to show that a theory of nature should be represented by a Hilbert space like quantum mechanics, that would not be the end. And here I tend to disagree with, for example, what Gilles was saying, that perhaps the entire physics is information. That is certainly not the case, in my view. Now, of course, the great advance in information was to disconnect from the physical world and try to give abstract things. But physics is not abstract. For example, different states in Hilbert space do not have the same significance. You have position eigenstates, you have momentum eigenstates. They are just some arbitrary eigenstates. But you can change momentum as quick as you want. You cannot change the position as quick as you want, because that will contradict relativity. So different states have different statuses. You also have conservation laws, like conservation of energy, conservation of momentum, which are some fundamental things about nature and which are here to stay. They work here in Newtonian mechanics, in relativity, in quantum mechanics, and presumably in any other theories. Also, quantum mechanics introduces some new variations. So, for example, in classical mechanics and in special relativities, there are the forces that are important. In quantum mechanics, you have effects via the potentials. This is, for example, the Aharonov bomb idea. And dynamical non-locality is very much related to that. Okay, so after this very long introduction, let me start somewhere, and probably there is no better place to start than the two-slit experiment. So in a two-slit experiment, you have these two slits, some wave is impinging on them, say an electron or whatever, and it propagates through the slits, it hits a screen, and will have some interference pattern. And let me call this psi 1, and let me call this wave packet psi 2, and the wave function psi would be e to the, okay, I promise to write much bigger, psi, can you see? E to the I alpha 1 psi 1 plus e to the I alpha to psi 2, and I forget a normalization factor. Now, the interference pattern is almost identical to what would happen if you have waves on the water. The waves on the water come, and they will give an interference here. And the exact location of the interference pattern depends on the phases. But that is an optical illusion. It is a dramatic difference between this particular interference and the interference on waves on the water. And that goes like that. If this is a dam on the sea, and here is the beach, and here are the water waves coming, if you just stand here next to this opening, you can see the waves going up and down, so you can measure what the local phase alpha 1 is. Similarly, if somebody else, say Bob, stands there, can measure the wave up and down. So then they know alpha 1 and they know alpha 2 separately. On the other hand, in the case, let me check how it goes there. Ah, all right. We know that in quantum mechanics, an overall phase doesn't count. So in effect, I can take e to the I alpha 1 outside. I'm left with psi 1 plus e to the I alpha 2 minus alpha 1 psi 2. And I can forget about this overall phase. It has no observational meaning. So the only thing that has the observational meaning is the relative phase between the wave at these two locations. So you already see a hint of non-locality. The phases that are fundamental for understanding the interference cannot be observed on a local basis. Okay? Right. Now, there are different ways in which you would like to proceed. But the important question is to follow what is happening to these phases. If I would like to come and put this particle in interaction with something else and so on. So you would like to understand the dynamics of the particle propagating through the two slits. Now, we are used to think in terms of probabilities, uncertainties, and so on. There's something else that is interesting that you can do. So for every single state psi, for every single state psi, you can look at observables which are such that psi is an eigenstate of them. So you can get a set of observables, A1, A2, and so on, such that A1 on psi is some lambda 1 psi, A2 on psi is lambda 2 psi, and so on. So these I will call the deterministic observables. They are observables for which the state is an eigenstate. And if I would know all of them, then I know the state. So now, the entire history of the evolution, I can look at a history of deterministic observables, because each of these has a really well-defined answer. What is interesting is to ask what are the deterministic observables that describe the interference. So like this, I take a step back from probabilities, because already I will see interesting phenomena just by following experiments that are purely deterministic. There are some of the experiments like this in the context of quantum mechanics. Okay. Now, every single observable on a single particle, and I'm not talking about entanglement here, is a function of x and p. So I'm looking at functions of x and p. So here is an interesting question that you may want to ask. And that is, given this thing, what are the observables that are sensitive to the relative phase? Because the relative phase is the only thing that interests us. Okay. So let me first simplify this. Instead of talking about two slit experiment in two dimensions like here with X and Y, I will from now on just look at a one-dimensional situation where I have two wave packets, psi 1 and psi 2. For simplicity, I may even think that psi 1 is identical to psi 2, is just translated in space, and here I will multiply by a phase. Can you see from the back? Can you hear from the back? Okay. Good. I forget a 1 over root 2. I will put it when needed. So first of all, I ask, what is the expectation value of x in the state psi? Let me call psi alpha the superposition of these two, where I put the index alpha to say that I have the relative phase alpha there. So psi alpha is psi 1 plus e to the I alpha psi 2. So what is x? Well, that's nothing else than psi alpha star x psi alpha dx, which is nothing else than psi 1 star plus e to the minus I alpha psi 2 star x psi 1 plus e to the I alpha psi 2 dx. And this has four terms. It has the term with psi 1 from here, psi 1 from there. So the term psi 1 star x psi 1 dx. Plus it has the other one with psi 2 from which alpha drops, because I have minus I alpha and plus I alpha. So this is psi 2 star x psi 2 dx. And now I have a mixed term. Psi 1 star x e to the I alpha psi 2 dx plus the complex conjugate. These two terms do not fill alpha. So they really do not see the interference. The interference is completely encoded in alpha. Alpha is here. But if you look at this term, you see something funny. Where psi 1 is non-zero, psi 2 is zero. And where psi 2 is non-zero, psi 1 is zero. So since I multiply these things here, this term is zero. So, the first conclusion is that the expectation value of position x is independent of alpha. Okay. What happens with x to the power n? So I just put a power n here. I will put an n there. I will carry the n everywhere, and will not change anything because it's zero due to the non-overlap between psi 1 and psi 2. So we find that no power of x depends on alpha. Okay. Well, what about momentum? So what is the expectation of momentum? That is the integral psi alpha star I d over dx psi alpha dx. And when I decompose it as previously, I have psi 1 star I d over dx psi 1 plus the integral psi 2 star I d over dx psi 2, the alpha term. Sorry, I erased what I shouldn't have. The alpha term drops from here, and I have now the integral psi 1 star I d over dx e to the I alpha psi 2 dx plus complex conjugate. There is no dependence of alpha here and there. This is the term that I should focus myself. But if psi 2 is 0 at the location where psi 1 is non-zero, also d over dx of psi 2 is 0 there. So this term is 0. So that tells me that the average of momentum is independent of alpha. And you can easily see that if I want the expectation to the power n, I will just have to take the nth derivative here, and that will not change things an iota. So p to some power m is independent of alpha, and in fact all powers x to n, p to the k, are independent on alpha. Every single function is a function of x and p, and no moments of the distribution depend on alpha. But nevertheless, I know that alpha will determine the interference when these two waves come together. So somebody, somewhere, must depend on alpha. And the question is, which is that variable? Okay? Well, you may think that there is no variable because every single thing can be decomposed, every function expanded in powers of x and p, and nothing depends on alpha. But there is actually a function. And here it is. Suppose I look at the operator e to the I PL over H bar, where L is the distance between the two wave packets. And I would like to look at the expectation value. Well, this is psi alpha star e to the I PL over H bar psi alpha dx. So it is, if I look, it is psi 1 star e to the I PL over H bar psi 1 dx plus the next one, that is psi 2 star e to the I PL over H bar psi 2 dx plus psi 1 star e to the I PL over H bar psi 2 e to the I alpha dx, and the last one, that is psi 2 star e minus I alpha e PL over H bar psi 1 dx. Now, what is this operator? E to the I PL over H bar is just a shift operator. It's a shift operator. It's the one that takes psi 1 and moves it by L. Perhaps I don't know exactly whether I need to take a plus or minus sign. That you can check. So this term is 0 because psi 1 is moved and has no more overlap with psi 1 here. That one drops. This one equally drops. This one equally drops because psi 1, let's see which one drops. This one drops because psi 2 is moved even further out. And I remain with this guy. Because e to the I psi 1, well, e to the I PL psi 1 is just psi 2. So this whole thing will just give me e to I PL over H bar will just give me e to I alpha. In fact, I now recognize that is probably the minus sign that moves things to the right. So it is this one. And if I take into account the normalization factors that I forgot all the time, I get this expression. So there is an operator that is sensitive to the alpha, and this is the shift operator. This is a non-local operator because it takes a wave function and it moves it far. And the lesson is that this is the only operator that actually encodes the relevant thing about the interference. You see, if alpha would be undetermined, it is like having a mixture of psi 1 and psi 2, and then I will see no interference. So unless I control alpha, interference is lost. So it is this particular operator. It is not yet a deterministic operator, but doesn't matter. We are on the right track. It is this operator that I really have to take care of, e to the I PL over H bar. Now, the interesting question is, what is the equation of motion of this particular operator? By the way, before I get there, you see something interesting that may challenge you mathematically a little bit. It's quite simple at the end. I have a wave function, and I can look at the, in fact, I can look at the probability distribution of the results of this operator. The probability distribution that emerges from applying that observable to this function. Now that probability distribution is independent, that is the moments of that probability distribution are independent of alpha. All the moments. This is just a function of P. So all the moments are independent of alpha. But I have many probability distributions that are different from one another because the expectation value of this thing does depend on alpha. So it is interesting, it is a mathematically interesting situation in which I have different probability distributions that have all the moments identical. Nevertheless, they differ from one another. It would be very interesting to try and see how that comes. In general, students are taught that once you know all the moments of a distribution, you fully know the distribution. That is completely wrong. Okay, so the interesting thing is now to follow the time evolution of this object. So suppose in general that I have a Hamiltonian that works on a single particle and that the Hamiltonian is p squared over 2m plus some potential v of x. Now, it is useful first to see what are the evolution of some simpler observables. So if I look at x dot, well, it's I over h bar, the commutator between x and the Hamiltonian. This is the Heisenberg equation of motion. So it is I over h bar x commutator with p squared over 2m plus v of x. I can forget v of x because it commutes with x. And the commutator between x and p squared is simply 2p. So this whole thing is p over m. So if I write here on the side, I have that x dot equals p over m, which is nothing else than the speed is the momentum divided by the mass. Right. Now, let me look at p dot. P dot is the commutator of p with the Hamiltonian, so I have to put a p here. So what do I get? Well, I over h bar. I can forget about the kinetic term, and I have just the commutator p with v of x, which is nothing else than minus dv over dx times h bar, sorry, and an I here, a minus I. So this is minus dv over dx. So if you look at the Heisenberg equation of motion for p, it's exactly like classical dv over dx. So you may be tempted to think that quantum evolution is very much like classical evolution. I just go from Poisson brackets to commutators, and it's the same thing, and the only important thing are the probabilities, or perhaps some terms in h-bar that I neglected. I might have neglect or might appear. Right. But that would be an illusion. So let's see, the interesting thing is what is the time evolution of e to the I pl over h bar d over dt. This is the important thing. Well, you can say this is nothing than d e to the I pl over h bar divided by dp times dp over dt. So this would be I L H bar e to the I P L over H bar times minus dv over dx, because this is dv over dx. So if I would write it here, d over dt e to the I P L over H bar equals I L over h bar e to the I p l over h bar minus dv over dx. Wrong. This would be perfectly valid if this would be functions. But they are not functions. They are operators. And when they are operators, you cannot apply such a rule. So in order to see what happens, you have to really do the Heisenberg equations of motion. So let's do the correct thing. And the correct thing is to take the I over H bar, the commutator e to the I PL over H bar with a Hamiltonian, P squared over 2m, plus v of x. I can forget this term because it commutes with my observable, so that's all I have, which I can write as e to the I over h bar, e I p l over h bar v of x minus v of x e I p l over h bar. Well, it is useful to take, for example, this guy outside. So it would be I over h bar, e to the I pl over h bar, v of x minus e minus I pl over h bar, to compensate the term I took out, v of x e to the I pl over h bar. What is this guy? Well, I have a function of x sandwiched between shift operators, so that is a shift of this thing. So this whole thing is I over h bar, e to the I pl over h bar, v of x minus v of x plus l. Just to compare with what I have there, I can also multiply by L and divide by L. So if I come here where I have my summary, this is classical. D over dt e to the I pl over h bar equals I L over h bar e to the I pl over h bar v of x minus v of x plus l over l. This is quantum. So instead of a local function, which is just the derivative of the potential, I have something much more interesting, which is the difference in potential between two points separated in space. This is nothing else than the Aharonov-Bohm effect. That is, there need not be any forces on this particle. I may have, on this particle here, I may have a potential that goes like this, such that the potential is constant at the location of one wave packet, is constant at the location of another wave packet. How could I achieve that? For example, suppose this is an electron, and here in the middle, I have a capacitor. And I open this capacitor, plus minus, or minus plus, I don't care. There are no forces outside. If this is a capacitor with infinite plates, there are no forces outside because the electric force due to the negative charge is compensated by the positive. But there is a difference of potential due to the force, the electric field that exists inside the capacitor. Your electron doesn't feel anything. Yet, this particular observable, e to the IPL over h bar, feels the difference in potential. And this difference in potential will affect now, because this lives in a higher potential than that, will affect the relative phase between them. And will affect the interference pattern the moment they come together. So I can open the capacitor, change the relative phase, close the capacitor, take the capacitor away, and now let the two wave packets come and interfere. And their interference would be different depending on how much I open the capacitor. And this happens without forces. There is no force acting on the particle. So just to come towards the end, if I look at the two-slit experiment, I can make a couple of comments. First of all, is that the only observables that are sensitive to the interference are non-local observables, such as e to the IPL over h bar. And these non-local observables obey non-local equations of motion. So here I showed you one particular way in which I can interact with the electron from a distance. But every time when you would have a two-slit experiment and you try, for example, to find which slit the electron went, you will interact with it. So there would be a second object that interacts with the electron, and there must be a momentum conservation. Okay? This is the difference between the quantum interference and the classical one. In the classical one, if I come and I modify the wave, I don't know, I put my feet in the water there next to the dam, and I modify it, I don't need to to exchange momentum, because there is no connection between wavelength and momentum. In quantum mechanics, there is the connection between the wavelengths is connected to momentum via h-bar. And then, if there is a second object that tries to modify the pattern, that object necessarily receives a kickback. Now, the interesting thing is not the exchange of momentum itself, but it is the exchange of variables like this that I will call modular momentum, because it depends only on P modulo H bar over L. These are the observables that encode interference. So if I would, just for the last thing, write this observable in a better way, what is important, it's e to the I p over p0, where p0 is h bar over L. And it is only this object, modulo 2 pi, that is important. And the way in which you go to the classical thing is, you see, this p0 that is modulo whatever I want to look becomes zero. So then these observables become essentially undefined. That's the way in which we get to classical physics. So this is all I had time to tell today. But what I want to stress is that I believe that this is a completely different facet of quantum mechanics. The quantum evolution is a non-local evolution. And without appreciating this and just thinking of the Hilbert space itself, that is important enough, but this is another important aspect. The next step you may want to do would be, can I find some generalized theories in which I want to generalize the equations of motion? Now, that is tough, and that is what I don't know how to do at the moment, because as far as correlations are concerned, well, there I can just postulate some correlations, some probabilities. Here, the equations of motion seem to be ingrained in the structure of quantum mechanics, so it is not clear at this moment how I can make a model independent analysis and then start to play with it. But okay, we need to leave something for future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Santu, for this very pedagogical talk. Are there any questions?
Yes, Luciana.
Thank you. So, I guess I wanted to push you on this last point that you finally made. How would you take this and turn it into some kind of principle? But more than that, and one of the advantages of taking the abstract sort of Hilbert space approach when you're reconstructing quantum theory is that you have a sort of clear part of quantum theory that's sort of generally applicable in all the places that quantum theory is applied, modulo the concern that usually people deal with finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. Whereas here you have a fragment of quantum theory which is specific to the sort of non-relativistic particle case. So if you were to go to quantum field theory or other places where quantum theory is very successful, it's not clear that a principle that was couched purely with respect to this situation would apply also there. So can you imagine a principle that would apply sort of generally in places where quantum theory might be applied coming from this kind of property?
Okay. Well, there are... it's a complex question because you ask many things at the same time. First of all, it is not an either-or. That is, I either prefer to go and prove the Hilbert space or go to the equations, but it is an end that I really, in order to understand nature as far as quantum mechanics is concerned, I need to understand both of them. both the fact that the kinematics is a Hilbert space kinematics, but at the same time the fact that the equations of motion are non-local. So these are two independent, well, these are two statements. There is a relation between them, but they are essentially two different characteristics of quantum mechanics. And unless you get an understanding of this, you really have no hope to understand quantum mechanics. So many effects, like interaction-free measurements, your paradox with the two crossed interferometers, all of them can be analyzed following what happens. And what happens is this type of non-local interaction between the bomb and the photon, or between the two, the electron-positron in your case, and so on. The other thing, this is not particular to non-relativistic quantum mechanics, because all I have here, I have a version of the Aharonov-Bohm effect, which in fact is far more general than what people think. People think of solenoid and an electron going out. No. The very moment you have any potential, the interesting observable, which is a non-local observable, is sensitive to the difference in potential at two different places. And this is the case in quantum electrodynamics, and it's the case in all the field theories. Now, it may appear simple here because I made it simple for you. I looked at the simplest case. But the message is it applies all the time. All the time that we have a structure in space, and they are not the forces that are important, but there are the potentials and this non-local exchange. And this occurs all the time, and I can show you many, many paradoxical situations that are built from this. But that was not enough time. So essentially, apart from very trivial situations in quantum mechanics, where you have two spins, one next to the other, so they really have no space extent, then you can ignore this thing. But the moment you have to take any sort of space extent into discussion, you immediately run into this aspect. Okay.
Yes. So I'm not sure if there's really time for this, but is there a way of expressing this paradoxical feature sort of entirely in terms of paradoxical nature of some manipulation you can do, like the manipulation of the capacitors, and how that affects an observation, perhaps at some later time?
Look, this whole subject is actually very old. So Yakir got these ideas in the mid-60s. On the other hand, this is a subject that is almost completely unexplored. So at the moment, there are four papers about it, three that are the original papers and one review that I wrote this year or last year. So although, and we have a number of unpublished results, all kind of paradoxes and things, but it is very, very early days because it is essentially not explored. So yeah, I'm sure it is, but one needs to look into it more carefully. Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Usually, it's the classical the connection to the classical mechanics and quantum mechanics is satisfied by the Ehrenfest theorem. Right. Please give me the comment. Is the non for the non-local operator? What's the happen of the Ehrenfest theorem?
Okay, so the question was that there exists a relation between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics via Ehrenfest law, which essentially says that the expectation value of the momentum, the change in the expectation value of the momentum, equals the average force acting on the particle. So the expectation value of dv over dx. Yeah, that is correct. But it is very, very misleading. And I tell you why. Misleading. The point is the momentum is an unbound observable. So I can show a beautiful paradox that goes like this. Suppose I have a number of capacitors here, many capacitors, and I have an electron in a wave function like that, covering many of these guys. Now, I put here positive, negative, so I open them, all these capacitors. So in each of them, the force that can be applied to the electron is that way. There is no force here, but there is a force in the capacitor. So I open them and I close them. All it can happen, according to Ehrenfest's theorem, is that the average of momentum is increased positively. I will just tell you what happens here. I will not prove. If I look at the originally, if this wave packet is very long, the average momentum is roughly zero. This is momentum. What happens is something very intricate. 99.99% of the particles, this is the distribution, the probability of momentum, will be negative, will go that way. The average, nevertheless, is positive because a very, very tiny bit will be here. So what happens, you have a local effect when the electron is in the capacitor that gives him a kick to the right, and you'll have a non-local effect that is induced by the phase differences put here that gives this majority. So I can make the capacitors smaller, keeping the same potential difference, so the force bigger. So it means that I will have less amount of the wave function entering the capacitors. I will have an even smaller peak that I will move even further out. Don't worry, in the back, there is a small peak here. So then I increase this thing, and I can have a world in which the Ehrenfest theorem that the average is positive is still correct. But you will never, ever see that. It's exponentially small. That's why you don't see it. You will just see it back via the non-local thing. On the other hand, the shift operator is a compact support operator. And that is much better behaved. Doesn't have these sort of things and have very many other interesting properties. Good.
Are there more questions? Okay. If not, let us thank Sandu again.
Thank you.
Now have a coffee break and we reconvene at 10 to 11.